know, the last time I got audited, maybe that's why they even had the cut by change. It was piddly stuff.
All rise, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Werke, Judge Shalhoub, the Honorable Randall Sleater presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning. And thank you for being available a bit ahead of time. We have file A18148, Stream Bend Properties LLC, and we have a number of appellants, and I'll just note, understand first, appellants apparently have agreed to divide. There's three appellants.
Three respondents.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at respondents saying appellant. You've decided to divide your time 5 minutes each, is that correct?
5-5-5.
Okay, and I'll assume you've decided the order, so when I turn to respondent, we'll know which, and just make sure you identify who you're representing, and when everybody approaches the podium, do identify yourself for the record, and as soon as the appellant's ready to proceed, you may.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you so much for taking us to hear oral arguments on this matter. The first thing I want to address is going to be the motion to strike that we filed. I just wanted to make sure that you understood where we
Thank
were
you.
Coming
what
from.
What I'll do on that, just note for the record, we'll address that in our decision.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So thank you. You don't need to add anything to it, in other words, today, but we'll just note it for the record and make a decision or include that in our decision.
Okay. Oh, and I forgot to identify. Did I identify myself?
No.
I'm Rachel K. Nelson. I'm appearing for all appellants, both Stream Bend entities and Mr. Hammond. So there's two issues to the motion to strike that we want the court to be aware of. Or did you want me to not talk about
Correct,
it at all?
Correct, if you would, yeah.
Okay,
just go
then
to the
just
substance.
Kidding.
Thank you.
Well, then I would then just turn to that there are three overarching things that we want the court to take away today. The first of those is some of the facts that are important here that we feel that the district court got incorrect. The first is that when the purchase agreement was executed in 2004, both of the purchase agreements, there is a reasonable expectation that the agreed upon terms would be successfully completed. The entities, the appellants, waited until 2009 to give respondents a chance to rectify the errors that they had seen take place, the failures they had seen to meet expectations. They gave the 20 days notice, and this claim arises from the initial failures to do what they'd say they'd do, doing what they said they shouldn't have done, and refusing to rectify the situation. And this is a really common set of facts, or a common set of claims given the facts. It's kind of the first thing we want the court to be aware of. We also want to highlight the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act claims. I'm going to just call it MCIOWA, if that is okay with the court, to shorten it, make it a little easier.
I've heard it so referred to before.
Yeah, and the Iowa reminds me it's IOA, not OIA.
Let me ask you this about that
yep.
claim. If this case involves a proper statutory cancellation of your client's interests in the purchase agreements as purchasers, would an MCIA claim survive the cancellation? And if you think the answer is yes, what authority do you have?
Okay. I'm sorry, could you, so if the claim survives.
Well, one of the arguments in the case is, is certainly by the respondents, is that the cancellation of your client's interests in the purchase agreement was a proper and valid cancellation. If your client's interests as purchasers in those purchase agreements was properly canceled, would a claim under MCIWA survive?
There's some debate about whether there was a cross-cancellation when there
but
was...
But I'm asking you just to assume, just for the sake
for
of
the
argument.
For the sake of argument,
yes.
Okay. If the cancellation by my client was not the initiating thing that started the whole ball rolling, if it was the respondent's later cancellation. If that were true, you know, this is kind of one of those things that is on a first impression type thing. It's hard to say. There's not a lot of authority. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has found that if you're adversely affected, you know, that is something that makes you have a claim under Common Interest Ownership Act. So there is some elsewhere, other jurisdictions, some precedent for having people who are just adversely affected have standing to make a claim. I also would say that you can't cancel, if you can't simultaneously make the argument that it was canceled, but it wasn't valid. So it's interesting to me that if the cancellation was valid, then that means that the purchase agreements themselves were valid. And so making that dual argument, to me, is kind of hard to wrap my head around.
Okay.
Okay. We also wanted to make sure the court is very aware of Exhibit C within the agreement itself. If the application of the language is correct, there's still the issue of where the earnest money then goes to. I think that if it was void, if the purchase agreement was no longer valid, that the earnest money then should have got back. And the fact that the court found that it was void and failed to return that earnest money that was then never rightfully the property of respondents was an error from the client's perspective.
Okay. I have a question for you in regard to the district court.
Yep.
In your brief, you refer to the district court's order as a jumbled mess of erroneous and contradictory findings. You refer to the district court as attempting to sneak in the summary judgment standard rather than following the proper dismissal standard under Rule 12. You state that the court is intentional, that the court intentionally committed judicial error in an effort to end the case. And you state that the Minnesota judiciary, on page 57 of your brief, is willfully and repeatedly violating the very documents, the state and federal constitutions, each of which its members has sworn an oath to uphold. For the purposes of your argument today, I'm going to assume that someone suggested that you include that language in the brief, but I'm also going to suggest that you give some thought to the inappropriateness of impugning the integrity of the court. We here are members of the judiciary, which you are harshly criticizing in your brief. You may continue.
Yes, Your Honor. If I just may respond to that.
You may.
When you look at the statistics that exist about jury trials generally, it might not, maybe willfully is a little harsh, and I apologize for being so harsh, but the statistics bear out that jury trials, which is a right guaranteed under the Constitution, are diminishing. And whether that's a mechanism of who knows what, it seems interesting to me that and there's so many issues of first impression on this case. When there are so many, when you're supposed to take what the complaint has, if there are facts that can be borne out, you know, if you're supposed to take that in favor and consider that as you're making a decision, and you still find a way to.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm really not interested in what might be fodder for a law review article.
Okay.
On page 60, you also say that the judiciary has intentionally made protection under the laws unequal. Now, I just think you should move on to the issues in your case.
Okay. Sorry, I'm gonna reserve the rest of my time for my response.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Counsel. And whoever wishes to go first, Counsel for the respondents, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Charles McDonald. I'm representing the Wischerman respondents, which is Wischerman Holdings, Wischerman Partners, and Paul Wischerman. In my limited time this morning, I want to make 4 points. First, res judicata bars the claim against my clients, Wischerman Partners and Paul Wischerman. And that's a res judicata argument that arises from plaintiffs' effort to amend in their federal complaint, which they commenced in 2010, I think it was. There was a determination in that federal action that the motion to amend was futile. And that futility was a final judgment. It was entered, it was appealed, and the Eighth Circuit affirmed. Now, it's fair to say, and I think the appellants seek to say, that at a point in time, the state law claims against the other defendants were ultimately dismissed without prejudice. But that is certainly not the case as to Wischerman Partners and Paul Wischerman. As to them, the futility determination is both final and it is a dismissal with prejudice. And it is well-settled law, as characterized by the Eighth Circuit, that the denial of leave to amend constitutes res judicata on the merits of the claim, which were the subject of the proposed pleading. So that's one point. The second point, Your Honor, I want to make is that the statute of limitations bars the claims against Wischerman Partners and Paul Wischerman. Under Minnesota law, service of a summons determines commencement, and these defendants were never served with any process until this lawsuit, the state court lawsuit in 2017. Now, appellants assert that maybe there's a relation back argument, but I'd ask the question, relate back to what? Because there's no previous state court action that wasn't commenced until this case in 2017. And Paul Wischerman and Wischerman Partners were never parties to the federal action, and so there was never any claim against them which could relate back. And so simply based on having commenced a lawsuit in 2010 and then trying to assert those claims against my clients 7 years later, any statute of limitations applicable to any of these claims would have expired. The third point I want to make, and it's a point that goes to the entire lawsuit, is that collateral estoppel bars this lawsuit. And the collateral estoppel arises from Mr. Hammond's prior efforts to assert identical claims against other condominium developments. And simply by looking at the cases cited to the court, you can see that we've done Carlisle, the Carlisle condominium project in Minneapolis. We've done Pinnacle Falls. We've done Sexton Lofts. We've now done Ivy Tower. All of these lawsuits were identical. They all asserted the same sort of claims. And in the Sexton Lofts lawsuit, judgment was entered by Judge Howard, Hennepin County District Court, against Mr. Hammond and his Stream Bend entities, finding that the purchase agreements were void because the Stream Bend entities did not exist at the time the purchase agreements were signed.
But in order for collateral estoppel to be applied, the issue must be identical.
Absolutely right, Your Honor.
And in the Loft case, I've forgotten the first word.
Sexton.
Sexton, thank you. In the Sexton Loft case, at least if I'm reading it correctly, there was not there weren't subsequent purchase agreements that addendums that were signed, by the purchasers, as there were in our case, arguably ratifying the original purchase agreements or adopting them. Am I right?
I think you are largely absolutely correct, Your Honor. The point that I would make in response, well, two points. One is that on the details of the adoption and promotion arguments, one of my co-counsel is going to speak to that. But as it affects collateral estoppel and this argument, Your Honor, I would argue that those are simply alternative arguments that they failed to make in Sexton Lofts. And the courts have been fairly clear in when they apply offensive collateral estoppel that merely offering new theories in an attempt to resurrect an already decided issue is not permitted. And I would suggest that's what's happening here. The last point, Your Honor, simply with respect to negligent misrepresentation, is our point would be that it was not pled with sufficient particularity.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And whoever's next for respondent, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Jamie Pennings on behalf of the Ivy respondents. That's Ivy Tower Minneapolis, Ivy Tower Development, Gobin Enterprises, Moody Group, Gary Benson, and Jeffrey Law. I am going to be addressing the breach of contract.
And I'm sorry, you said Jamie Pennings?
Jamie Pennings,
very
yes.
Good. Thank you.
And wrongful cancellation claims. We ask that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of these claims, as well as all of the claims against all respondents with prejudice. First, the district court properly decided the breach of contract claim because the de facto corporation doctrine is not acknowledged in the state of Minnesota, and both of the Streambend entities did not exist at the time these purchase agreements were executed. There is some argument that appellants make that there was a colorable attempt to incorporate and failure to incorporate, but that is just simply not the case because these entities actually were incorporated.
But at the time that the purchase agreement addendums were signed, wasn't the incorporation complete?
That is correct, yes.
And so why would that not constitute a ratification or adoption?
Well, because ultimately the appellants objected to the purchase agreements and requested return of their earnest money. I would argue that regardless of what had happened before that time, that objection evidences lack of adoption.
But your clients accepted the additional earnest money when the addenda were signed.
That is correct, yes. Do you have a further question? Okay. The purchase agreements were also void because, again, here we go for the adoption. I'll move on to Streambend 8, which could not have adopted because Christine Hammond was not a promoter for Streambend 8. Streambend 8 purportedly signed the purchase agreement. Christine Hammond signed that, but there are no allegations that she is in any other way involved in the management of Streambend 8, was not involved in the incorporation of Streambend 8. There are no allegations that she entered into or procured this purchase agreement or performed under the purchase agreement. And all of the case law that is cited regarding promoters shows that a promoter must engage in more than simply signing the contract.
Your point being the first contract may have been ratified, if we use that phrase, but the second one not, or I don't know, 2 and 8. Two would be ratified, 8 wouldn't be, for that reason you're just identifying?
Correct. However, I still disagree that it would have been ratified by the separate addendum.
Did the trial court address the letter, I understand, that came before your client's cancellation notice from the appellants wishing to get their money back? Did the court address the adequacy or lack thereof in terms of notice as it relates to your client's notice?
Well, technically, the district court did address the letters because it acknowledged the objection to the purchase agreements and the request for return of earnest money. I believe that's on pages 10 and 11 of appellant's addendum. But below, there were no allegations that those letters in any way complied with the statute 559217 in any way initiated any sort of cancellation proceedings.
After the letters, you went ahead and did the formal statutory cancellation.
Correct. Right? Yes, that's correct.
Incidentally, the letters are not a part of the file, but I don't know that it matters unless there's an argument that the letters are construed as a cancellation.
That is correct. Further, it was never alleged that the letters either complied with the purchase agreements. So below, the only argument was that the declaratory notices of cancellation, the Ivy respondents' declaratory notices of cancellation, were somehow did not present unfulfilled conditions. That was their only argument below. I would also like to address the declaratory judgment claim as properly dismissed because the purchase agreements were void and because there was a proper declaratory cancellation by the Ivy respondents under 559217 subdivision 4. The district court did acknowledge that appellant's only recourse under that statute was to seek the suspension of the cancellation within 15 days, and they did not pursue that option. And if there are no other questions?
I don't think so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And I'm assuming we're down to counsel for Commonwealth that responded. Or up to, however we want to look at it.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Carrie Trapp. I represent Commonwealth Title Insurance Company. As a roadmap, I'll address a few of the topics that haven't been raised by my colleagues. First being the wrongful conversion, unjust enrichment, the MKIWA violations, and then as specifically relates to Commonwealth, the Minnesota statute violation claim under 82.75 and the negligent misrepresentation breach of fiduciary duty as to Commonwealth specifically. As to the wrongful conversion claim, there are three bases that you can uphold the district court's dismissal of the claims. First, the funds were subject to an express written agreement that they could be used for construction, which is consistent with the MKIWA requirements.
What is the complaint getting at when it alleged that the escrow monies were used for immoral purposes? I couldn't quite follow that in terms of the complaint or the briefing.
Well, I can't speak to exactly what is meant by immoral purposes, but I know with respect to Commonwealth, they allege that the payment of title insurance premiums directly correlated to a pay down of the loan with Doherty funding, and I'm not certain of the factual basis for any of that is true, and a lot of the briefing that Commonwealth put forth is that, frankly, these funds weren't used unjustly. They were used precisely how they were contracted to be used. There's no real allegation that Commonwealth, anyway, or frankly any other party, used them improperly in the sense of using them in a way that did not comport with the construction costs. Costs of lending, title insurance, things that are part and parcel of a development are construction costs. They're not immoral costs just because they bring down the ultimate loan amount with Doherty funding. So I can't speak to exactly why it was termed immoral. Moving on to an argument that has been briefed by all the respondents here, the funds were not in a tangible form and were commingled with all other funds from potential buyers in their earnest money payments. And under the case law that we submitted in our brief, specifically TCI, there can't be a claim for wrongful conversion in that sense. The third reason that you can uphold the district court's dismissal is that the statute of limitations clearly bars at least the first withdrawal of funds. The complaint itself describes that having been done December 20th, 2005. So even with the tolling due to the federal case under 28 U.S.C. 1367D, the time frame in which they had to file the district court case here had lapsed at least 1,000 days before they filed it. So moving on to the MCIWA claims. Again, as briefed, Commonwealth isn't even included under the statutory language. They're neither a declarant or an affiliate of declarant. And in response to a question that the court had asked appellant, even if the cancellation, if the cancellation went through, does the MCIWA claim stand? And they now claim in their brief that, yes, they are a party that is adversely affected, and throughout a number of cases that are not at all on point for the specific holding they wish it would say. In fact, they don't come out to say that anybody has standing. And in the cases that are, you know, in the in our brief on pages 16 and 17 with Pepper Tree and, sorry, I don't recall the first name, neither support the recitation that just anybody, because even there, they were condominium owners that didn't have standing to sue their condominium association. So we would argue that there is no remaining MCIWA claim. So similarly, the declaratory judgment claim fails because that there are no standing claims left to bring that. With respect to the Minnesota statutory claim under 8275, that does not allow private causes of action. And I see my time has expired.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you may rebut if you wish.
So first, in regard to the Wisherman arguments that were made by Mr. McDonald, regarding plaintiff's effort to amend in the federal case, when discovery happened, it was revealed that Mr. Wisherman, that $175,000 had gone somewhere in 10 months. So that wasn't known. And so with that knowledge, it seems interesting that they want to still be let out of the case, even though they will never then have to answer for that apparent behavior, like to respond to where it was going. I would also talk about the collateral estoppel stuff. As you pointed out, each addendum and the earnest money associated with each addendum was accepted. And once the LLCs were formed, they accepted those as having been formed. So if we're going to void the first thing, then none of the anything. And again, the earnest money should have been returned as having not ever rightfully belonged to, because they were never part of a valid agreement. And then I would also like to highlight that the 5.59.217, there's some fundamental disagreement about whether subdivision 2 or subdivision 4 applies. Under subdivision 2, the letters that were sent by appellants met the requirements of the agreement itself as far as how to cancel, effectively cancel the agreement.
Did you ever make that argument in the district court that those letters sent constituted a statutory cancellation?
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
You didn't make that argument in your complaint, though.
Maybe not. Yeah, I know we made it though. Yeah, it was just they were, and we included all the different agreements and everything as part of the submissions as well.
Are those letters in the record someplace? We have not been able to find them.
I thought they were. Where are they not part of the?
Where would we find them?
I thought in the addendum. Are they in? Maybe they're not. Otherwise, I'd be happy to provide those.
I'm just wondering if you could. I'll look again at the addendum.
Yeah, okay, sorry. And then I also just wanted to highlight that Really what happened here is that things were overpromised and underdelivered, and my client really wanted to accept the give the benefit of the doubt to the developers that they were going to follow through on the commitments they had made. And it became apparent to him, and under Exhibit C, that his earnest monies could be taken and they could still not follow through on the agreement or on the promises. That is when he decided to effect the cancellation. And it really comes down to that they couldn't have performed the agreement, the initial agreement couldn't have been performed even if they had wanted it to be. It was at a point where the property was in distress, there was liens, there were things happening. This is a multi-year process that occurred. It was not like a single day.
Council, I just want to let you know you're down. The light doesn't reflect it, but you've got 1 minute.
Okay. I guess I'll just move to my closing then. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing here before you today. We appreciate the court's questions, and thank you very much. We just want you to please consider granting our motions to strike and our underlying appeal. Thank you so much.
Very well. Thank you to all counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling. The court will be in recess until our next scheduled hearing, which is 12:05.
I'm always the pokey one. Sorry.